had this.
Or this.
Yeah, or this.
Or that. Okay.
Yep.
Thank you all very much for sticking with us despite the threats of snowfall in DC. Obviously, all of you are locals and you therefore know that we have these kinds of threats of Armageddon on a regular basis, but they're never quite as powerful as we expect, with the exception, of course, of a few storms last year. Before I introduce this closing plenary and our guest speaker, I want to make a few thank yous. I want to thank the staff of the Science and Human Rights Program, Jen McCreadis and Carl Bogart, who unfortunately was ill and had to leave during the course of the day, Susan Wolfenbarger, Jonathan Drake, who also is ill and had to leave during the course of the day, and Ashwan Reddy. I want to thank Mark Frankel, who's the Acting Program Director for the Science and Human Rights Program, and also the staff of Science and Policy Programs who've helped considerably with this meeting, particularly Bethany Spencer, whom all of you will have seen outside, and also Becca Carlson. I also want to thank Dexter Cooper and the staff in Building Services for all of their assistance. Now, in October 2008, the AAAS Science and Human Rights Program, together with the Coalition Working Group on Service to the Human Rights Community, launched On-Call Scientists. On-Call Scientists is an initiative aimed at encouraging and facilitating the practical connection between scientists willing to give of their time and knowledge with human rights organizations in need of scientific expertise. This morning, the opening plenary panel addressed the topic of how science and scientists can help assess, monitor, and protect human rights in the recovery of earthquake-devastated Haiti. This evening, we remain in the Americas as we have the privilege of hearing from Professor Dinah Shelton, member and soon to be president of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. Yesterday, Professor Shelton and I were discussing this evening's presentation, and she mentioned the many and varied ways in which scientists are needed to support the work of the Commission. Tonight, we'll hear about how anthropologists, linguists, forensic experts, water contamination experts, and others are needed to support the work of the Commission in their investigations and in their adjudication of cases. Whether in a project of the Commission or another organisation committed to protecting human rights, I encourage you, if you haven't already, to sign up to volunteer through On-Call Scientists and learn how your knowledge and skills, the methodologies and the technologies with which you work, can further human rights. I now invite Professor Shelton to present us the work of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights and her case for how scientists are needed in the pursuit of human rights.
Thank you very much, Jessica. I'll start with the bad news. As I was walking up from Metro, it began to snow, so you missed your chance. Hopefully it won't be bad. It was just very light. I'd like to thank you very much for inviting me to be here. My brother and son also thank you. My brother, the scientist who works at JPL, and my son, the paleoanthropologist, because they're tired of having me call only them for answers to my questions. So hopefully out of this we'll have a greater network. I'm going to start by introducing the Inter-American Human Rights System, because even though it is a system in which the U.S. is a founding member and full participant, it is much less known than the work of the United Nations. So it's a chance to do a little publicity, but also to explain the need we have for scientists. And it is a two-way street because we also provide support for scientists through our Human Rights Defenders program. So So the Inter-American Human Rights Commission is a part of the Organization of American States. It is every independent country in the Western Hemisphere. Sadly, we don't get Guadeloupe or Martinique or St. Martin, some of the other wonderful islands in the Caribbean, but we do get Easter Island, which belongs to Chile. So all 35 independent states in the OAS created in 1959 a seven-member commission to monitor and enforce human rights in the Western Hemisphere. This was about 10 years after they had adopted a declaration on human rights. So every member of the commission is nominated by one of the member states and elected to a four-year term by the OAS General Assembly that meets every year in June. So I was nominated in March of 2009 and elected in June of 2009 to start a four-year term in January 2010. So I've just completed my first year on the commission. The elections are usually contested. As you can imagine, with 35 member states, there are usually more states that want to have a member of the commission than there are available seats. We only turn over half the commission, or usually three seats every couple of years. Even though we're nominated by the governments, we do not sit as government representatives. We sit as independent experts. Of course, as with all international bodies, some are more independent than others, and some are more expert than others. So you see there the photograph of our current seven members, with me on the left, Paulo Sergio Pinheiro, who's Brazilian, Luz Patricia Mejia, who's from Venezuela, Felipe Gonzalez, our president, outgoing president, is from Chile, Rodrigo Escobar Gil, who is Colombian, Maria Silvian Guillen from El Salvador, and Jose de Jesus Orozco, who's from Mexico. So we represent a wide range of member states. This is the first time in a long time we do not have someone from the English-speaking Caribbean, which has an impact on how the workload is divided. Each of the seven members is a rapporteur for a certain number of countries, which means we have the primary responsibility for monitoring the situation in those countries. Because I'm the only English speaker, I got the English-speaking Caribbean, and I'm still hoping to get a boat to visit all of the islands. I also got Haiti, so I'm very pleased to know that you were working on Haiti this morning, as well as Guatemala and Chile. So with that, I'm kept pretty busy just looking into the country situations. But we also have thematic rapporteurships. All but one of them deal with particularly vulnerable groups. The one that doesn't is on freedom of expression. But the others concern women, children, migrant workers, detainees, indigenous people, and human rights defenders. So with my country assignments of Chile and Guatemala, it made sense that I'm also the rapporteur on the rights of indigenous peoples. So I have responsibility for looking into the situation of indigenous people for the entire Western Hemisphere, including Easter Island. The headquarters is in Washington, D.C. It's right behind the World Bank, 1889 F Street, so it's not too far away from here. We're not a full-time body. We meet three times a year, 2.5 weeks in the spring, a week in the summer, and 2.5 weeks in the fall. The spring and fall sessions, we conduct hearings. We actually hear cases. We have petitioners who come. We have government representatives. We hear witnesses during that time. We also hold thematic hearings on issues of interest or problems in the Western Hemisphere. With that, and being the only member who is present in Washington, D.C. year-round, it's a little bit difficult. The Secretariat does a lot of the work in the meantime. So what do? We're to monitor compliance with the human rights obligations of all the member states. We hear and decide cases. We can take cases to the Inter-American Court of Human Rights if the court has jurisdiction over the particular country. We issue precautionary measures when there are urgent cases that threaten irreparable harm to individuals or groups. We negotiate friendly settlements where it's possible to do so. And we make on-site investigations, usually when there's a case presented or when an entire country is in crisis. We went to Honduras the month after the coup d'etat in 2009. We can only make those on-site investigations with the consent of the government. It is very rare these days for a government to refuse. Often they will defer us for a while, but every country I've asked to visit in the year I've been on the commission has accepted us. And we engage in standard setting. If we see gaps in the law, we propose new norms to the governments. So what are the human rights obligations? Well, every member of the OAS must respect human rights pursuant to the treaty that founded the Organization of American States. And in addition to that, they have additional obligations. Every member of the OAS is expected to conform to the rights in the American Declaration of the Rights and Duties of Man. That's the basic obligation. In addition, a state can ratify a separate treaty, the American Convention on Human Rights. 25 of the 35 states have done so. Of those 25, they may additionally, each one of them, declare that it's willing to accept the jurisdiction of the Inter-American Court that sits in San Jose, Costa Rica. And 22 of the 25 have. So almost two-thirds of the states have accepted the notion that they can be taken before a court that issues binding judgments and can issue reparations. The failure to comply with any decisions of the commission or court is reported to the political organs. And those political organs can take action, which they have done in the case of Cuba and Honduras by suspending them from participating in the organization, or take other kinds of sanctions, which happened in the case of Nicaragua under Somoza. But it requires political will, and so it has to be a really serious case, usually involving one of the smaller countries, before you actually see this type of action taken. Fortunately, compliance is relatively good within the hemisphere. So just in terms of the rights of indigenous people, as I say, that's the thematic rapporteurship that I have. The acronyms are for the Declaration and the Convention. We apply the Declaration to states that have not ratified the Convention and the Convention to those that have. But in addition, we make reference to broader international human rights standards. There's a Convention on the Rights of Indigenous People that the International Labor Organization adopted, Convention 169, which is a very, very detailed advanced agreement specifically on this issue. So we look to that for guidance. We also look to the UN, to the Indigenous Declaration that recently President Obama announced the U.S. is now supporting. We were the last government to announce support for it. When it was adopted, there were four governments, U.S., Canada, Australia, New Zealand, four governments with large indigenous populations who've withheld support from the Declaration. All four of them have now reversed their position. So we look to that as well. Now, in terms of how things proceed, in addition to having those instruments, we also have developed jurisprudence. So on indigenous people, we issue country reports talking about how governments relate to their indigenous people. We've issued three major cases recently, the Yanomami case involving Brazilian Amazonia, the Mary and Carrie Dan case, which involved the Western Shoshone people against the United States, and the Tolita Maya case, which is actually still in litigation, involving Guatemala. The court has issued a series of judgments against Nicaragua, against Paraguay, and against Suriname. All of those judgments, and this is just an example, the first one, Awatzinchni, involved the government of Guatemala licensing Korean logging companies to come onto traditional indigenous territory and clear-cut the forests, taking away much of the support for the traditional subsistence activities of the Awatzinchni. They filed a lawsuit in Nicaragua. They won. The government promised not to do it again and then did it again. So the second time around, they came to the commission. The commission found in their favor, took the case to the court, and the court ordered the government of Nicaragua to suspend the licenses of the Korean company, cancel the logging concession, to demarcate and give title to the indigenous lands as communal property. 2 years later, in December of 2009, the government and the indigenous reported that there had been full compliance with the judgment and the case was closed. So with the participation of the Awistinjni, the government representatives literally walked the boundaries of the traditional territory and then granted title to the indigenous group over that territory. So they now control their own resources. So when we look at what governments are doing, we're looking at enforcing their own laws. As we expect that whatever laws a state adopts, they will actually comply with them and enforce them. That they respect and ensure human rights to those within their territory. And if rights are not guaranteed that comply with the treaties that they've adopted, that they should legislate those into effect. So they have a duty of adapting their internal law to their international obligations, and a duty to cooperate with the commission and the court. So one of the things I did in September was to go to Paraguay and visit a number of indigenous communities that had pending cases. This particular community, the Yaque Axa, was expelled from their lands when a German company bought a large part of the territory on which they traditionally lived. And they are now living in, you can sort of see in the background there, their schoolhouse. All their houses are built in the same way. They're essentially just bamboo or logs that they have put up, dirt floors. There's about 500 people in this community, and they're trying to get their land back. So we went with the consent of the government. We met with government officials. We then went to the community and looked at the conditions under which they're living. We sat out in the open. We met with the leaders. We met with everyone in the community to find out what their situation actually is. And here's the first time we needed a scientist. Not one of us spoke Guarani. And many of the people in the Yaque Axa speak neither Spanish nor English nor any other language other than Guarani. So we had to have interpreters with us to assist us in determining what the situation actually was. This is, on the left, the single latrine for 550 people. That's all they've got. The alternative is they walk along that trail into the woods and find a place. So that's one of the things we were concerned about, and one of the issues on which we need some advice on how do we design a system for this community. So these are just some of the people we met with there. And then we sat down with the government representatives and the leaders, and because this is subsequent to a judgment issued against the government of Paraguay. So the issue was, how well is the government complying with the judgment? What do you need? And the community listed their needs. We had representatives of the government there, and after about 10 hours, we had a negotiated agreement, which we got signed. The government is sending us monthly updates on what they are doing to comply with that agreement. We do occasionally run into confrontation. This was another effort to see an indigenous community that happens to be enclosed on the lands of a senator who's hired his own private guards. And they threatened to decapitate the Indians who were bringing us to visit this territory. So we had to make a very long detour, including a four-hour burro ride in the jungle at night, crossing the river, not knowing what was in the river, to get to this community. And in the end, the army came in and got us out. So it's not always easy. But when the court takes a case, the state has already had a duty to afford access to justice, due process, and reparations for any violations that have occurred. If they fail to do so and the case gets to the court, the Inter-American Court has more power to afford reparations than any other international tribunal in the world. It can order restitution. We had a case involving Fujimori, who had detained a lawyer for defending some suspected terrorists, guilt by association. They threw her in prison. The court ordered her released, and within 3 weeks, Fujimori complied. Restitution of lands of the indigenous is typical as well. If restitution is not possible or if it's inadequate, the court can also award compensation, not only for out-of-pocket expenses, but for moral and dignitary harm. Also, the court very often demands that the government acknowledge publicly its responsibility often in a public ceremony, apologizing to the victims. This usually happens when it's been a state policy of disappearances or massacres or other forms of repression. The judgment has to be published in major newspapers, on radio, on television, so that the public is aware of the judgment against the government. Often memorials or other forms of symbolic reparations are ordered as well. And these are cumulative. These are not in the alternative. So the court, since it started functioning in 1979, has issued now about 200 judgments. Many of them have full compliance. Others have partial compliance, and the court continues to monitor compliance and never closes a case until there is full compliance. So that is a bit of an introduction to the inter-American system. Now, where do we need science? Where do I need you to come in and help us? Well, you've already heard about Haiti. I'm the rapporteur for Haiti. I would love to have some really good assessments of what's going on there. Even if I go to Haiti, I will never be able to see all of the situation that's there. We get reports from NGOs. They're advocates, and they often represent particular groups. They may or may not be accurate. So getting accurate information is essential to the credibility of anything that we issue under the name of the commission. In the area of indigenous peoples, I can give you a couple of examples. We need different types of scientists. I was in Panama at the beginning of December to look at a case involving our neighbor in Virginia, AES, building a series of hydroelectric projects that involve very large dams that are inundating indigenous lands. In the beginning, there was no consultation. There was a lot of forced relocation that was going on. It's very clear that a number of communities are going to be completely underwater. So there are ancestral sites there. There are artifacts there. There are burial grounds there, all of which need to be identified and need to be moved to safe places. The indigenous themselves, under inter-American law, have not only individual rights but community rights when they are recognized as an indigenous group. The problem we had in this section of Panama where the current dam is being built is that there are three recognized communities that the government, the indigenous, everyone recognizes as communities. And then there's another set of people that there's a debate over whether they are actually an indigenous community or simply isolated individuals who left because they didn't like their community, but they now want to be considered a community because the communities are getting not only state-of-the-art housing with solar panels very near to where their original villages were, but they're getting community centers, health clinics, schools, soccer fields. They're getting, in essence, all the services that a town would get in Panama. So if this other group is a community, they're entitled to that. If they're not a community, they'll be treated as individual property owners and compensated accordingly. So it makes a big difference. And it was extremely contentious, going literally from one side of the river where this group was to the other side of the river where people were screaming, they're not really a community, to the point where the lawyer for the dissident group had their boat confiscated so that they couldn't come talk to us. So it does get quite contentious. And it really makes a difference in terms of territory, land rights, communal rights, whether or not this constitutes an indigenous community or not. So that's one case. Probably the biggest area that we need help right now is in environmental claims. There's a certain amount of environmental issue coming up in the dams case. There will be much more coming up in the case of what's likely to be the second or third largest dam in the entire world that is currently at the stage of being licensed for construction to go in Brazilian Amazonia. And it will take away one of the most biodiverse regions in the world if the dam is actually constructed, not to mention completely taking away all the ancestral territory of about 8 to 12 indigenous populations. So we face it with large dams, but we face it even more with extractive industries. We've got probably a third of our cases involving Central and Latin America right now, and even some concerning Canada, are cases in which mining is going on, often gold mining, oil exploration and exploitation, in which the petitioners allege that their soil, their water, and their air is being polluted to the point where they are suffering severe health consequences. Now, I can make an on-site investigation. I can drink the water and look at it, but I can't do any kind of scientific analysis of the contents of that water. And in the biggest case we have right now, the Marlin mine in Guatemala, we have 15 indigenous communities claiming that Marlin mine, which is owned by Goldcorp, originally Canadian, now U.S. company, has polluted all of their drinking water, their wells. It's a typical gold mine operation. It's using a cyanide leaching process. There are 6 environmental impact assessments that have been submitted to us, 3 by the petitioners, 1 by the government, and 2 by the mine. They all conflict. And it's very difficult for us to be able to assess the validity of these assessments, whether they were done correctly or not. Each one claims the other one is wrong and they're right. But we have to decide whether the government has failed in its obligations to protect these communities, which depends in turn on whether they have wrongfully licensed this mining operation to the detriment of the health and well-being of these communities. So we've been in contact with the Pan American Health Organization to see if they would support sending scientists down with us to do an assessment of the soil and water. Certainly there are a few of the allegations that we have been able to assess, such as the mine has caused a measles epidemic, which we have trouble finding causality. But there are other issues where it's really, really not so clear. The third area in which there has already been tremendous scientific help to the human rights community has been when there are disappearances and massacres. We are continually faced with uncovering mass graves where there have been periods of civil war or repression. Guatemala has the highest number of disappeared people in the world. 14,000 people disappeared during their 30-year civil war, including 1,200 children. The mass graves are being uncovered. The government has offered to do DNA analysis. For obvious reasons, the survivors are reluctant to give their DNA to the government because there's a backlash that's going on by those who were responsible for these massacres in the first place. They don't want forensics done. They don't want the people the remains identified, and they do not want cause of death attributed or timelines, because it may correlate with when a particular military battalion was in a particular region. So there's a lot of problems there with trying to get good forensic evidence. Although there is now a coalition that has set up an alternative to the government that's trying to create a data bank and do the kinds of forensics that are necessary. So far, Guatemala has not really engaged in the kind of repression of forensic scientists that we're currently seeing in Peru, where there has been a tremendous effort to shut down independent forensic analysis. There have been a number of graves that have been uncovered, and the forensics have shown from the types of bullet casings that were found, from the trajectory of the wounds, that this was clearly point-blank massacre by military weapons. The government response is to say that this is not credible, and the forensic scientists have been prohibited from doing further work. Their labs have been shut down in some cases, and they have been threatened. So they need support. We do have our human rights defenders operation. We are considering scientists in this position to be human rights defenders, and we will issue precautionary measures where necessary. Another area, individual deaths. We had a hearing on a case out of Jamaica. Very typical. Jamaica has one of the highest rates of extrajudicial police killings in the world. They're averaging about one a day, so 365 last year. The evidence is always the same. The petitioners come in, usually the mother of a young man, because typically this is the victim, and the mother says, my son was having a beer in a bar. The police came in without warning and simply opened fire and killed him and his friend. The government then comes in and testifies that they had heard reports of threats. They had come. Somebody in the bar had a gun, and they had shot in self-defense. And, by the way, gunshot residue was found on the hands of one of the victims. Never any independent autopsy done. So we're faced with what I call dueling narratives. The petitioners say the killing occurred in one way. The government says it occurred in another way. We have no way 7 years later of uncovering the truth of what happened. If we can get evidence closer to the time when this occurs, build up cases, then we have a much better chance of coming out with a credible report that will force the government to do something about this problem. Allegations of torture. Governments are getting smart. They're not leaving physical evidence of torture, particularly when it involves sexual abuse. And we had a case involving Peru in which a woman claimed she'd been sexually abused in prison, but they did it relatively early in her detention, and by the time she got out, there was no physical evidence. But it may be that there's enough psychological aftermath and evidence that we would be able to show that something had occurred to her that was seriously traumatic beyond simply the detention. The final area in which we're getting a growing number of cases is reproductive rights. The whole issue of reproductive rights, particularly in Central and Latin America, is probably even more controversial than it is in this country. And to give you one example, the president of Costa Rica a couple of years ago invoked American human rights standards to say that embryos were entitled to the right to life, and therefore, under an executive decree, in vitro fertilization would only be allowed for married couples who could demonstrate a physical impediment to reproduction through sexual means, and only six embryos could be created, and all six had to be implanted to give them the maximum chance for life. This was taken to the Constitutional Court of Costa Rica, which declared the law unconstitutional because of the probability that some of the six embryos would not survive and they had an entitlement to life. So that resulted in a total ban on in vitro fertilization in Costa Rica, which remains in place today. The commission decided this case in July and decided that this law was a disproportionate invasion of the right to privacy. Costa Rica currently has a new law under consideration, but it probably won't be adopted in time to prevent the case from going to the court. So that case is likely to be decided within the next year or so. But we're getting a number of these cases. Nicaragua currently has a law that has a complete and absolute ban on abortion, even to save the life of the mother. And we've had a case of a 14-year-old victim of incestual rape who is faced with dying because she can't get an abortion. So we've issued precautionary measures on her behalf. We are currently studying the issue of legal discrimination that exists in a number of countries against homosexuality. Trinidad and Tobago has the death penalty for consensual adult homosexual acts. Jamaica has just increased its penalties from 15 to 35 years for adult consensual homosexual acts. So In this, we need to do a lot of educating of these countries about the state of science on many of these issues. And we need to really constantly monitor what is going on because there is always a risk of backsliding. So just to sum up, human rights law is facing constantly issues of scientific evidence. Petitioners have to prove their allegations, so they need that evidence. We need to know if that evidence is credible. They lack resources to, in many cases, when you're dealing with rural indigenous people in Guatemala, they don't have access to scientific expertise. And we don't have a single scientist among the seven members of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. The court can appoint experts. We can invite experts. PAHO has funding to support experts. So we are inviting you to join us. And I hope we will have the possibility to work together on some of these cases in the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much to Professor Shelton. We have finally today some good time for question and discussion. So I invite you to come to the microphones and please just introduce yourself and your organization or department and ask your question.
Mark Frankel, and as Jessica mentioned, I'm serving as acting director of our science and human rights program. Thank you for your very informative talk. Just to be pragmatic for a moment, what do you have in terms of resources to bring the scientists to these countries, whether it's your budget or it comes through some other source such as the countries? I don't know. Could you say a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, our resources would probably cover travel and expenses. The court, if it appoints experts, can add an honorarium onto that. So there's probably advantageous to get in at the level of the court. With the Marlin Mine case, we've asked PAHO to come up, the Pan American Health Organization, to come up with funding for this independent assessment of the various, the six EIAs that have been done, and to go with us to Guatemala. So if that comes through, there will be funding to support the people who come along. I can't put a dollar figure on it. Our annual budget is, I think, about $8 million. It's not huge. Like most human rights bodies, we're the least funded part of the OAS. We're about 1.5% of the OAS budget. But PAHO has a lot of money because, of course, they deal with the cholera epidemic. They deal with all of the medical issues. And so that's why we're trying to partner with them as a way of being able to fund these experts to come in. Yes.
Work,
yeah.
It might be geographically closer, less expensive perhaps, et cetera.
Right. We can. What we try to be extremely careful about is that we don't want to get into the dueling scientist problem that the World Court has had when it's dealt with some of the environmental cases. So you had the case of Uruguay versus Argentina over whether a pulp mill was going to create pollution on the Uruguay River. Each side had its national scientists who were completely vested in the outcome. So we want to avoid that. We also want to be very careful that we don't put anyone at risk. And there may be cases in which if we hire local scientists, we're going to have to monitor to make sure there's no reprisals afterwards. Now, in theory, the government is never supposed to take reprisals against anyone who talks to us. And with most governments, I would trust that, but not with all of them. I should say another thing about funding, too. There are several well-funded NGOs in the U.S., the Center for Reproductive Rights in New York, is very well funded and could use some scientific help on some of these issues. They actually represent some of the petitioners, and for instance, the girl in Nicaragua is represented by them in the case that we have. It's getting a little bit more formalized. It used to be that there was no coordination except on an individual basis. But recently, the UN has started organizing meetings to bring together the three major regional systems, the European, the Inter-American, and the African, together with counterparts in the UN to talk about issues of coordination. So there was a meeting of that type that was held in November. That was the most recent one. And it does allow for some coordination on that of that type. I work closely with the UN Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Whenever I'm going to a country, I ask if he's been there, if he's going. We talk about it. If it's in the Western Hemisphere, he's got the whole world to deal with. So we don't overlap on everything. If he's going to Australia, I don't talk to him about that. But he's been to Guatemala. He's seen the Marlin Mine. He's been to Paraguay. So we do compare notes on that. We try to coordinate strategies so that we maximize each other's efforts in a way that will further human rights. We've actually talked about making a joint mission at some point in the future.
Good evening. My name is Susan Wharton-Aroha. I was impressed when you talked about how the countries would work with you and give you permission to go in the country and investigate the human rights violations that are going on. It just startled me. How long does that usually take, and what type of strategies you use to get the countries to comply with your wishes? And just totally surprised. They were so cooperative.
I was, too. I wasn't expecting it when I made my first on-site mission. Governments come and go, and to give Paraguay as an example, during the 30 years of the Stroessner dictatorship, the government never even answered when the commission wrote about a case or to make an inquiry. It was just absolute silence on the part of Stroessner. But what often happens is after a period of repression, you get a very strong pro-human rights government because they want that international safety net. Their domestic system has completely failed them, their constitution, their courts, everything. They've been under military dictatorship or civilian dictatorship. And so we've seen in Argentina, in Chile, in Guatemala, and other countries that when these periods end, they rush to ratify the treaties and they want the cooperation of the commission. So in those circumstances, we can really make advances in working with the new government to strengthen their domestic institutions. In other cases, you may have a split between the executive branch and the legislative branch, and they're using us for their own purposes. Now, you know, we understand that, and if we can work with that in a way that makes human rights better, so much the good. In other countries like the U.S. and Canada, where you have very strong civil society and NGOs, that's where the pressure comes from, not so much from us, but from the internal processes. The commission I should have said at the outset, we're not allowed to sit on any matters concerning our own country, just to keep the impartiality. So I can't even know what cases against the U.S. are pending. Just before I came on the commission made an on-site investigation in the United States of the treatment of immigrant detainees in detention facilities. They worked with both the federal government and state governments to visit along the southern states immigration detention facilities to see if the treatment being afforded complied with the standards of the OAS. And they had done that once before with Haitian detainees, Haitian immigrants during the boat people, and Cuban detainees during the boat people influx. And they actually were able to get some changes made as a result of this process of dialogue. And certainly when I go into the countries, I go in with an open mind. The petitioners have made allegations. The governments have responded. I always meet with the government officials. What surprised me in both my first two missions was I was sort of expecting to meet, like, the assistant to the undersecretary of state, you know, for Latin America or something of that type. No. First thing on the agenda, president of the country.
Whoa.
Then the head of the Supreme Court, the president of the Senate. Right on down, and it astonished me. And in Panama, I think I met with every cabinet member. So I think that for whatever reason, historic, political, many of the countries in the hemisphere take this very seriously. They're very proud of the fact that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was largely supported and pressed by Latin American countries when the UN was founded. So it would take a really great sociological study to be able to begin to understand why it actually works as well as it does.
About how long does it take you to get approval to go into the country to do the investigation?
It really varies. Usually it comes quite quickly. To go back historically, when the Pinochet coup occurred, it was September 11th, 1973. The commission was there September 20th, 1973. Wow. Okay. In the case of Panama, it was very rapid. We were running up against a deadline. Now, I mentioned funding. My rapporteurship this year was funded by the Danish government. We solicit outside money ourselves. And that grant was running out at the end of the year. So my assistant called me up in just before Thanksgiving and said, we've got to spend this money before the end of the year. What dates do you have open? Wrote to the government of Panama and said, we'd like to come the first week of December. And within a week, we have the approval to go. So for us, it's really a matter of prioritizing. And once we've done that, the governments are usually cooperative. Now, we've got a couple of cases this year where they've said, this is not a convenient time. We wanted to go to Brazil, but it was the week before Brazil's application to host the Olympics was being considered. They didn't really want to have a human rights investigation while the Olympic Committee was looking them over. So they said, can you come later? So, but it can happen extremely rapidly.
So. Thank you.
I have a question,
mm-hmm.
If you don't mind. I was just wondering what types of expertise or sort of vetting process is required before, for example, a scientist would be considered sufficiently expert to be an expert or an expert witness for the purposes of the commission report?
The only thing I know about this is the court's process, and the court has primarily used anthropologists. One of the early cases that they had involved the Maroons or the Saramaca people in Suriname, a rather unusual group because they have many of the characteristics of an indigenous tribe, but they're not. They are the descendants of escaped slaves who got away from the boats and went inland and recreated their African tribal society in South America. So they're matrilineal, they're polygamous, they've got their own unique culture, they develop their own language by melding the different African tribal languages. and the Surinamese government, during a military dictatorship period, massacred most of the young men in one of the Maroon villages. And it didn't require scientific evidence about the massacre. The government then changed, and the government admitted having massacred these young men. The question was, how do you calculate compensation or reparations to a non-monetary polygamous matrilineal society that is based upon a head woman structure. And the court there threw up their hands and said, we've got to have some experts. And they sent out a call. They took in Stevie. They did their own evaluation of the experts. We have not had an opportunity to do that during this year I've been on the commission, so I would welcome suggestions as to how we ought to go about doing it, because this has given me now a new forum in which to look for people who can help.
We have 5 more minutes.
I'm just curious as to your actual meetings. You meet 3 times a year for at least 1 to 3 weeks. It's here in D.C.?
Right.
Are any parts of your meetings open to the public?
Yes, they are.
Okay.
You can go to iachr.org, and it will list the periods of session for this year. And about our next session is going to be, I think it starts March 17th. It'll run for about 2.5 weeks. And about a month ahead of time, they'll be posting the list of hearings, so you'll be able to see what types of hearings we're going to hold, and you're welcome to attend any of the hearings. They're open to the public. So, and that's at 1889 F Street.
Okay. And also, I mean, would the commission be open to having a presentation by members
Absolutely.
Of the coalition about the work
yeah.
that we do?
In fact, you can request a hearing on the role of science and the work of this committee, and say you would like to make a presentation and open up a dialogue as to ways we might collaborate. Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great, thank you.
And I'll recommend that they accept your request.
Can I build on that question? You mentioned that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was largely supported by Latin American countries because the American Declaration actually preceded the Universal Declaration
right.
by a few months. Now, a right with which we're particularly interested in the coalition is a right that's in Article 27 of the Universal Declaration, the right to the benefits of scientific advancement
right.
is the wording of the mm-hmm. Universal Declaration. And
we
right,
used that in the in vitro case.
Oh, you did. Well, that right is obviously also reflected in the convention. Now, we're involved in a process of contributing to what the UN is doing to try and define that right. Would there be an opportunity for us to work with the Commission in the context of the American
Absolutely.
Declaration?
Absolutely, yeah. Or if the UN is holding meetings, I mean, if you're actually working in some sort of a group development project, we could certainly send a representative to those meetings as well.
And as follow-up, how are the rights contained within both the Declaration and Convention given substance when they're not rights that are generally spoken of, such as freedom of expression and so forth?
Partly it's through the case law where, you know, we have to apply that right to a specific fact situation. And since that's been going on now for 50 years, we have a considerable body of jurisprudence that we draw upon when new cases arise. But then something like this in vitro case, it's brand new. And we have to sort of work by analogy. What has been the scope of the right to privacy in the past? How does it apply here? We will look to other systems. The European system decided an in vitro case. So we look to see whether it was coherent and convincing. We look to the UN law. We try to draw on all of these different sources. But we also issue reports. We've got a brand new report coming out in, it's at the publisher right now, that is on the land and resource rights of indigenous people. It's a major study that sort of pulls together all these standards and offers guidance to governments as to how to implement specific rights. We've done one on access to maternal health care that came out last year. So we do these thematic reports as well. Yes, sir.
Yes, matter of terminology. The coalition, of course, is called the Coalition on Science and Human Rights. But within the coalition, even today, we've been hearing some discomfort with that language, and some of the groups within the coalition are changing the terminology to STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Am I correct in assuming that your needs for technical support extend across that full spectrum, not just what is narrowly considered science?
Well, certainly technology. We run into a lot of issues of technology. I'm trying to think of a case where math would be, you know,
well,
give me a math case.
Statistics.
Yes, statistics, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, one of the issues that where this comes up is I mentioned the cases of extrajudicial killings in Jamaica. At a certain point, when we see a pattern that someone can demonstrate is statistically significant of the same kinds of things occurring over and over, we shift the burden of proof to the government and say, "You prove you're not doing this." So that would be very important in that context.
Thank you.
Well, I think we've reached our time. Thank you very much to Professor Shelton. And I thank you all as members and hopefully members-to-be of the coalition, and also specifically to the steering committee and the working group co-chairs for all of the effort that you not only have put into today's meeting, but that you put in throughout the year into the work of the coalition. So thank you very much. And I invite you all now to join us for some food in the outside auditorium area. Thank you.
And just a reminder, please do your evaluations for the speaker and for the coalition as a whole. We would greatly appreciate them. We need them. Please do them.